On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. The LA District Attorney announced today that 8 officers of the LAPD will not be charged in a case of mistaken identity. 2 years ago, former cop Christopher Dorner was on a rampage threatening murder, and the manhunt was on. In Torrance, Margie Carranza and her mother, Emma Hernandez, were delivering newspapers from a pickup truck. The officers opened fire on the women. An incident chief Charlie Beck and the police commission agreed was out of policy. Peter Biebring is director of police practices at the ACLU of Southern California. Good to have you back on our program.
Great to be here, Warren.
What about this situation? Is this one, do you think, where in fact the LA district attorney ought to file charges?
Well, that's a hard question. I mean, certainly the officers in this case facing the situation that was created in the manhunt for Christopher Dorner were under pressure, and I think that the public recognizes that. But when they fired on this car, the description was close to the vehicle, the description of Dorner's vehicle. The license plates were close, but obviously they did not see a gun. They did not see Dorner. The department has recognized that this was out of policy, and close is not good enough when we're talking about officers firing more than 100 rounds into a car. And I think that there are a couple of points here. I mean, first of all, the district attorney's office in LA has at best a mixed and arguably very poor record on filing charges against officers who use force. She has filed some in some cases, but she's declined to file in cases such as against the officers who shot Ezell Ford, the CHP officer who beat Marlene Pinnock in an incident that was captured on video and resulted in a multi-million-dollar settlement of more than $1 million, and declined to file against L.A. Sheriff's Department deputies who beat a visitor to L.A. County Jail who was even though those officers were ultimately charged by federal prosecutors and convicted in federal court. And there have been calls for her resignation because of her failure to file charges in so many incidents. But I think it's also important to recognize that while the district attorney's office is not providing really a meaningful check on officer misconduct, part of that is structural. In a case like this, where so many of the failures of LAPD were not just the decision of the officer at the moment to pull the trigger, that was certainly a failing, but part of it was tactical, the training that the officers received, the briefing that the officers received. Criminal liability for the individual officers is not going to be the way to get at those more structural problems. And that's why it's so important.
You mean because they were told that this was a desperate situation, they were after a very dangerous man. After all, Dorner did kill 4 people ultimately and wound 3 others. You're saying that because of the way they were briefed and the things that they were told, then that's justification of a kind? There were 100 rounds fired into the truck. The 71-year-old woman, Emma Hernandez, was shot twice in the back. Her daughter...
No. Yeah. I'm certainly not saying that. I mean, police, look, we hold police to a high standard. We give them weapons and we give them the right to use them in certain circumstances, but we hold them to a standard of professionalism, and that has to include professional conduct in incredibly high-stress situations. What I'm saying, though, is that the criminal charges against the officers involved, even if they were charged, would not necessarily reach the people who made the tactical decisions and the training decisions that resulted in this error, which is why it's so important to have changes to the structure of accountability, the way that we hold officers accountable. For example, the internal investigations into uses of force, even uses of force like this one, as serious as this one, are confidential under California law. That has to change. The public has to have a right to full access to any kind of use of force investigation involving such a serious use of force.
That's because of the Police Officers' Bill of Rights, so-called, which was passed by the voters.
It's actually not the Police Officers' Bill of Rights. It's a statute called the Pitches Statute that were passed.
But doesn't the Police Officers' Bill of Rights suggest that it would be difficult to change the law in this regard? And isn't one of the reasons that officers aren't prosecuted more often the difficulty of getting a jury verdict, such as happened in Baltimore?
Well, I mean, we've seen, for example, in the case of Gabriel Carrillo, that in who was the individual who was beaten by sheriff's department deputies while visiting the jail, the district attorney's office declined even to file a case, while the federal prosecutor not only filed a case but obtained conviction. So, look, juries may not convict in every case, but that's not the limit on Los Angeles District Attorney's Office and other district attorney's offices filing charges. They're being very deferential to law enforcement in their decisions to file charges.
Don't they need law enforcement in order to be able to do their jobs?
Well, yes. And in fact, that's why there has been a movement in California and elsewhere to create independent offices to review, investigate, and prosecute uses of force and particular shootings involving law enforcement officers. So it's a real question whether a DA's office that, as you point out, relies on the cooperation of police day in and day out can really be in a position to file charges against them. And that's why creating an independent prosecutor or an independent investigator or even an independent division within the California Department of Justice to review investigations and make recommendations about filing charges would create some independence, some better independence than local district attorneys have.
In the meantime, as you indicated at the outset, more such cases still to come. We'll see what happens.
Certainly.
Peter Biebring, always good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Director of Police Practices at the ACLU of Southern California. In a moment, is L.A. still the car capital of the world? On Which Way L.A.?
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app, available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
Well, and I'll be back with Which Way LA. California's economy depends on transportation, but money is running short to repair an aging infrastructure. Billions are being spent on public transit, but ridership's going down. Let's start with state support for repairing the roads, the bridges, and the freeways. Lauren Kay is president of the California Foundation for Commerce and Education. That's a think tank affiliated with the State Chamber of Commerce. Lauren Kay, welcome to our program.
Glad to be here, Warren. Thank you.
Governor Brown called a special session to come up with $5.7 billion for maintenance and upkeep. Now there's talk of $754 million in transportation money cut. What happened?
Well, that cut is a symptom of an overall problem we have in transportation funding, which is the gas tax is inadequate to keep up with the need.
So is that because people are driving less or because the gas tax hasn't been increased?
Well, it's a couple of reasons. First of all, inflation has taken its toll. About 20 years ago, when you were first on the air, the gas tax was raised to be about 18 cents a gallon. That hasn't changed since over the past 20 years. And since then, inflation has eroded it to be about 7.5 cents a gallon in value. So we've lost over half the value of the gas tax just to inflation. Add to that the fact that we're a victim of our own success in California. People are driving less. They've got more fuel-efficient cars, and so we're buying less gasoline. That's great for the environment, but it's lousy for road finance.
If the roads are in bad shape, what does that mean for the economy?
Well, it's bad all around. It's harder and takes longer to move goods. It's much harder for people to get to work, especially in the parts of the state that are growing and creating jobs. We have, in some parts of Los Angeles in the Bay Area, there are hour-long commutes. So it makes it a whole lot more difficult for businesses to grow and for people to have a good quality of life if they do have a job.
We're in the middle of an election year. What are the chances of increasing the gas tax?
Well, the governor has proposed that. There are people in the legislature talking about it. It's a very tough bill to pass because, frankly, neither Democrats nor Republicans like raising taxes. On the other hand, there's really not much of an alternative over the long term to add more money into transportation.
When he was elected, Governor Schwarzenegger famously did not increase the car tax or allowed it to decrease. What about that?
Well, the car tax doesn't go to roads. The car tax is basically it's a property tax on cars, and most of that money goes to local government for their use.
Okay, what then about a mileage fee? I understand you're pushing that.
Well, I was part of a committee appointed by the administration to look at the mileage fee, and frankly, that's a good option. For one, it charges users, drivers, for their use of the road. The more you drive, the more you pay. Secondly, it doesn't depend on the price of gasoline or the amount of gasoline used for its revenues. It depends solely on how much drivers drive. So it will not erode based on fuel economy of cars. And thirdly, as we move into an age where there are fewer gasoline-powered cars and more electric or fuel cell vehicles, those drivers will pay. So it's fair in that regard as well.
How do you monitor that? How do you know how far anybody's driven?
Well, there's all sorts of options. You could self-report. When you go in to get your car inspected, you could have them look at your odometer. Some drivers might choose to have their smartphone keep track of their driving. There's all sorts of different options, and that's the sort of thing that will be tested over the next year in this pilot project.
Okay, there's one thing that might change the way people live. Lauren Kay, once again, with the California Foundation for Commerce and Education. Now, Los Angeles got a famously slow start at building light rail and subway systems. Then voters passed Measure R in 2009. $9 billion will complete the Foothill Gold Line and the Expo Line to Santa Monica this spring. There are plans for more, but it turns out that public transit ridership has not been growing. In fact, L.A. Metro reports today it's been on the decline for the past 10 years. Same thing's happening in Orange County. Denny Zane is executive director of Move L.A. That's a group that advocates for public transportation. Denny Zane, welcome to you.
Hi, Warren. Good to talk to you.
Is this money being ill-spent if, in fact, the ridership is declining rather than going up?
Well, Measure R systems have not really yet opened. The first light rail line will open in March, the Foothill Gold Line extension, and then the Expedition Light Rail to Santa Monica will open sometime in May. So in terms of Measure R, we're really just beginning to see the outcome of that vote.
But obviously a lot of public transit has been built prior to Measure R, and if that's the case, and it's also true in Orange County, why do you think ridership's going down?
Well, this is a trend nationally, and it's certainly true it's happened in Los Angeles as well. The recession had a huge impact, not only on unemployment, which brought ridership down, but also damaged the budgets of operators all over the country. And many of them had to either cut service or increase fares, and all of that reduces ridership. There's no question that having more alternatives like the Ubers, the Lyfts, and more bicycle infrastructure has an effect on people's choices. People have more choices now, and transit has to compete with that. Interestingly, the operators who have really done better in the last few years are those like Long Beach Transit, Foothill Transit, and Santa Monica Big Blue Bus, which have created universal student transit pass programs. Those properties have really done much better.
There are those, including people at the Reason Foundation, others who take a dim view of this kind of planning, who say that the problem is fundamentally that people don't want to get out of their cars. They would rather drive than go on public transit.
Well, a smart transportation system gives people choices, and if they would rather drive, happily they'll be driving cleaner and cleaner vehicles. But giving people choices is the smart thing to do, and we find that if you create efficient systems and make them conveniently available, safe and secure and fairly priced, low priced, then you'll get people to use them. Having alternatives, I think, is the smart way to go.
Denny Zane, again, executive director of Move LA. Brian Taylor is director of the Institute of Transportation Studies at UCLA. Hi, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren.
Transportation planners have argued for a long time, as Denny Zane indicated, that if there is a choice because of climate change and because of traffic congestion, people will choose public transit. But is there a fundamental flaw in that argument?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things going on. I want to tie the first two speakers' comments together. One is that, in general, we're able politically to rally voters and elected officials around investments in new capital projects, be it a new bridge, a new highway, a new rail line. But there's a lot of focus and ability to kind of marshal support for these new sort of ribbon-cutting opportunities. There's a lot less enthusiasm among the voters to pay for operations and maintenance. And, of course, you know, you could have a fleet of brand-new airplanes, but you're not going to have many passengers on your airline unless you're able to run it effectively. So one of the challenges that many systems are facing, and it goes back to the road and bridge system, is that we're very challenged on the side of being able to operate and maintain what we have and put the service out there in the most effective way possible when we're really able politically to get money for new projects, not sort of operating continuing.
Well, it seems to me it's an argument for public transit if, in fact, the automobile opportunities are declining and things are getting worse.
Well, it's not that the opportunities to drive are getting worse. It's that the driving conditions are getting worse, which
okay.
is somewhat different things. I think that you have to understand that there's a variety of public policies that affect how you use and travel around the city. So if you have a city that has minimum parking requirements that it basically require free parking at every destination, that's a very big cost, being able to house a private vehicle. And most drivers assume that there's no cost at all, that's to be provided. So when you walk or bike or ride transit to a store that has a big parking lot, when you pay for a good, it's helping to subsidize the people who drove there. So these kinds of things affect choices a lot. In the same way that the cost of providing transit that we charge people through fares is considerably less than it costs us to provide the service. So we have a distorted system where people aren't essentially paying the cost of traveling around the region. And it shouldn't surprise us that when you price something below what it costs to provide it, that people consume more of it. So they travel more and more, and they make their decisions about where to live, where to work, how to configure the city around the idea of cheap transportation. Then we end up with a problem where we have chronic congestion. We're trying to address it in various ways. The last thing is the issue around public transit, I think, is one that is complex. It's related to demographics and the changing demographics of the city, the slow recovery from the recession, low fuel prices. All of these things are paying into a problem that we have with public transit.
Let me go back to Denny Zane with Move LA. There are skeptics who say that if, in fact, you make people pay what Brian Taylor refers to as the real cost of transportation, what you're really doing is pushing them out of their cars.
Well, that would be, I think, in many respects, a good thing to accomplish. Transit systems themselves need to be subsidized because a large share of their ridership comes from the low-income workforce. And, you know, I think pricing matters, and Brian Taylor makes a very good point.
Let me go back to Lauren Kay with the California Foundation for Commerce and Education. Once again, that's affiliated with the California Chamber of Commerce. Does the chamber look favorably at the idea of making people pay what's called the real cost of transportation, even though the argument against it would be you're making people do something they don't want to?
Well, part of the problem there is figuring out who, you know, what the real cost of transportation is and who's going to make that decision. What we really need to start with is paying for what the infrastructure that we have out there and the infrastructure that we need. There's a lot of decisions that people make into where they live, and part of it is where they work and what they can afford. Charging people for parking lots at shopping centers isn't probably going to change those decisions. The first and foremost question, though, is how are we going to pay for the roads that are out there, that are falling apart, that are congested, paying for the transit systems that people will use? Those are the immediate questions that are facing the policymakers.
Brian Taylor, back to you with the Institute of Transportation Studies at UCLA. Is this a situation where, as you indicated earlier, there are just a lot of holes in the financing system, or do we have basic disagreements about what our goals ought to be?
I think that you've hit the nail on the head. There isn't a lot of agreement about how to proceed, what sort of development patterns we can agree on. You see, in Santa Monica, there's big fights about whether density should be increased and we should do more to try and improve transit and increase walking and biking, but in doing so, make congestion worse, or do we try and put a cap on that development? And until you have some general agreement on what the city ought to look like and how you want to get around, do you want L.A. to look more like Houston or more like New York City? Those are big questions. What we do is sort of a little bit of everything, and sometimes trying to do a little of this and a little of that is worse than not picking one path and following it.
Denny Zane with Move L.A. You used to be the mayor of Santa Monica. How do you respond to what we just heard?
Well, I think Brian doesn't have exactly an accurate view of it. There were some major market rate developments that were disapproved in the city, but those are not developments that actually contribute to the transit system, because the transit system really provides its core ridership as the low-income workforce, and the developments that were frowned upon were market rate high-end developments. So we really need to make, I think, transit-oriented development reflect the ridership of the transit system, which means including significant low-income people.
But then you got to get ridership to increase when, in fact, it's on the decline.
I think there's a challenge, certainly, especially when gas prices are going down, like Dr. Taylor pointed out. And we need to improve service, expand service, and create more effective first-mile, last-mile connections to make it easier to get people to the system. We need to invest in security and safety to make sure people feel comfortable. And we need to expand the base. We need to expand the base by creating TOD with affordable housing in it, near transit stops. And, you know, that's a challenge, but it's a challenge we can meet.
Okay, obviously one of the most important issues that we have to deal with having to do with public policy and the way everybody's individual life is affected. I want to thank you all for being with us. Denny Zane, once again, Executive Director now of Move LA, Brian Taylor at UCLA, Lauren Kay with the Foundation for Commerce and Education. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Warren.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. Once again, Which Way LA will be ending its 23-year run tomorrow. But I'll still be hosting To the Point on KCRW. In a moment, a cut-down version of today's program on the race to the White House, economic inequality, and an angry electorate.